attributes.
شاعری کے مختلف ادوار ہیں مثلا ابتدائیہ جو شاعری ہے
علامہ's poetry consists of certain periods
his poetry was at first as the poetry of the day
جو وقت گزرتا گیا اصل میں تو ان کی شاعری
he would say at that time my Urdu poems are like a building made of clay
جیسے گارے کی عمارت بنانا
Little by little, his Persian poems came into existence. Among the first Persian poems were the familiar secrets and the mysteries of rapture. Such poems end with Javed Nome, or perhaps with What Can Be Done, O Eastern People.
Gradually, Iqbal changes from a national poet to the poet of the Islamic world. His versified story, The Familiar Secrets and the Mysteries of Rapture, is first translated into English by Reynold Nicholson and published in the region. Years later, his Javedname is translated into German and Turkish in 1957 by those who study Islam, including Anna Marie Schimmel. The book is published in Munich, Hermann Hesse. The German writer and a winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature writes an introduction to Javedname, as requested by the translator. Hesse writes, Sir Muhammad Iqbal belongs to three intellectual domains. His works are the outcome of these three intellectual domains, Indian intellectual domain, spiritual domain, and Western thoughts domain.
There are three groups of Persian poets. The first, those who are absolutely meaning-oriented.
Iqbal, as a poet, is highly accomplished. He has bridged the gap between wisdom and heart.
The second, those who are pedantic. Meaning is absent in their poems. They pay attention to words and nothing more.
His poems touch the reader's sensations. Because they are so meaningful and precede even the thoughts forming in their minds.
The third, those whose poems are full of both words and meanings. From among them, we can name Hafez and Saadi.
Such senses calm mind, imagination, and consequently heart. This is a rare attribute seen in such great poets as Hafez and Rumi. The attribute is common in all Iqbal's poems.
Allama Iqbal has mastery not only over words but also over various meanings which come out of him and are derived from his thoughts. His meaning-oriented poems outnumber his other types of poems, just as Rumi's. Iqbal says, There is no comparison between the melody and me. Speaking is only a pretext. I am pulling the camel, which has no rein.
Allama Iqbal, with a faith in Islam and a reasonable Gnostic faith indicating his deep certitude in God's sovereignty, moves his mind to search for secrets and mysteries of the creation. In his Islamic Gnostic poems and such verified stories as The Souvenir of Hijaz, The Eastern Message, The Familiar Secrets, and The Mysteries of Rapture, he talks about the principles of internal ontology of things, an idealization of the existential world. While his thoughts are at the height of their powers, he invites Muslims to solidify familiar philosophy exactly in accordance to monotheism, to bring about a new perspective, a new worldview, into the Islamic world.
So many memories are related to this house. My father came to live in this house when he was 11. Now, what sort of memory do you want me to tell you?
Talking about Iqbal's thoughts reminds us of the familiar thoughts as his central train of thought. We hear Iqbal saying, to a mullah, a denier of God is an unbeliever. To me, more unbeliever is he who denies his own self.
Just ask, what is Iqbal's philosophy? The answer is, the philosophy of your own. Iqbal's philosophy is in fact the philosophy of one's own, or familiar philosophy. What is familiar philosophy? That you know your origin very well.
Never in my life have I been interested in the world's wealth or posts. I built this very house just to accept my wife's repeated requests. My wife's fate in this house had a different form. Here became a safe place for those in search of their identity. I clearly saw that most Muslims in the motherland had lost their Islamic identity, and to regain it, they need to struggle hard. The house, quiet corner, became a place for those who wish to fly faults of self-belief, something much needed by all.
The house originally belonged to my father, Javed Iqbal. The house title deed had already been issued to my grandmother. Upon the death of my grandmother, the deed was transferred to my father. Allama Iqbal would live here as my father's tenant. He paid the rent to my father every month or every 3 months.
Never did I lose my interest in my native land's people. My best time was when I was among people to see them struggle hard to earn their living. I was inspired by their uproar in the Anarkli district. Loftier than the heavens is the station of man, and the beginning of education is respect for man.
Iqbal lays heavy emphasis on the familiar secrets and mysteries of rapture. Familiarity, as seen by Gnostics, means to entertain the self, to fully know the self. It's a famous statement that knowing the self is meant knowing God. Iqbal emphasized, first and foremost, returning to the self. Search within yourself in order to know the self.
Iqbal invites us to know ourselves before doing anything else. Anything else. We shall heighten ourselves to become a human being, par excellence.
From God's own being, the self got a being so. From God's own show, to self he gave a show. About this shining pearl, I know not where. It could be then without a river there.
Iqbal meant to look carefully at human beings on the one hand, and to look carefully at Islamic ideology on the other hand. For that very reason, we see Iqbal describing in detail the Eastern society and the essence of Islamic thought.
Who is a selected man? A selected man is the one who is searched for by God. He is in a form desired by God. God wants that kind of human being. This is possible only if man searches for himself, to train himself in a desirable way, to maintain the self, to try hard to fully understand the self. This way finally leads to knowing well the Supreme Being.
The greatest message of Iqbal, as expressed in his poems, is to know yourself, to turn to your own self, to know the East, not the West.
Signs of going senile. tick-tock of the clock shows clearly the passage of my life. So quickly pass opportunities. So little time have I to reach the end of the line. Oh, the memory of those days when time's sword was allied with the strength of our hands and unveiled the face of truth. Our nails tore loose the knot of this world. Our bowing in prayer gave blessings to the earth. From the jar of truth we made rosy wine gush forth. We charged against the ancient taverns.
इस घर की तामीर हमारी दादी की ख्वाहिश पे की गई थी पर वो इस घर में
सिर्फ This house was built under my grandmother's wish.
उनकी यहां पे बीमार
But only for two or three days she lived here.
चौथे दिन वो फौत पा गई. उसके बाद
She was sick when they carried her in a car. But she survived only for two or three days.
मेरे वालिद साहब 11 साल के थे जब उनकी वालिदा फौत
At the age of 11 my father lost his mother. When my aunt was about 6 years old.
मामूल बना लिया था कि वो दोनों बच्चे वालिद और
My father and my aunt would come here every day to see Alama. Who was lying on this bed. Alama called them and my aunt would come up to Alama and my father would sit on the other side of the bed. This way Alama would feel comfortable.
मैं उनके चली जाती थी शाम के वक्त शाम होनी तो स्कूल से आके
I usually went to see them after school.
मैंने तो उनको इसी आदत
Alama was always lying on his bed and resting.
मैं पास जाके लेट जाती थी तो वहीं पे सारे मेहमान
I was always beside him.
हर वक्त लोगों
Other people would also go there.
मिलना मिलाना मुसलसल ही जारी रहता था
इस घर में कई लोग अलामा को मिलने आ चुके हैं कायद आजम मोहम्मद अली जिन्ना
Many came here to see him. Among them General Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Jawaharlal Nehru, Muhammad Ali Jauhar and many other intimate friends of Alama.
अलामा साहब अपने बिस्तर पे बैठते थे और
They would come here just before or after midday to have a chat with Alama about topics like poetry, philosophy or any other things.
तो ये
Alama spent his last days of life here.
I was well aware that the main reason why India went under the yoke of British colonization was lack of knowledge of self and reliance on others. Self-awareness springs out self-dependence and internal richness. Know yourself. Know your hidden parts. Nurture your parts and create a new world, which will compensate for old shortcomings and soul defects to pave the way for comprehensive development. It is the self which originates existence. It is self-awareness which gives birth to human values. It is the self which affects existence. What human beings see or intuit is a manifestation of the self through mysteries. The form of existence is an effect of the self. Whatsoever thou seest is a secret of the self.
Iqbal's philosophy is objective and tangible. He pulls down philosophy from the metaphysical world to make it tangible and applicable to common people. Iqbal's philosophy is therefore a practical philosophy. It can be put into practice.
O Muslims, you have to preserve your own self. You must follow God and His book, the Holy Quran. When you achieve success in making your own self, you can resist even the whole world. No one can harm you. What is the basis of survival? Survival? Survival is based on making your own self. It is the self, the nature mentioned by Quran. And this is the essence of Iqbal's thoughts. This is what Iqbal means of the concept of self. For that very reason, every member of the Islamic world should know this way of thinking, personally and socially.
Today we see a group of ignorant people who commit, under the name of Islam, the most heinous acts, though they are all against Islamic teachings. In fact, they are all Satan's companions, and toys in the hands of those who want to mislead them. About these people, Iqbal says, Europe very well knows how to secure interests, while granting to this takes the loan of that. It gives sustenance to Satan in a way that leaves perplexed even God.
Nowadays, there are calculated plots against Islam. The enemy is very active to destroy the Islamic world from within. I personally think that we need Iqbal's ideas about Islam now more than ever before. You are simultaneously a learned man, a Sayyid, the descendants of the Prophet. But tell me, are you a Muslim too?
A Muslim is called infidel by another Muslim. It is not a non-Muslim who calls him infidel. It is a Muslim. All problems are created and spread here and there by those who are pursuing only their own interests.
The phrase which brings unity to you all is, there is no God but Allah. As Iqbal says, the key to our unity, salvation, and survival, and a sign of familiarity, is in this phrase, there is no God but Allah. Those who follow this phrase never behead Muslims. Iqbal's basic philosophy is that all of us should be unified. All of us should form one single family. Muslims should get unified to guard the sanctuary. I mean Muslims from the Nile shores to the city of Kashgar.
Iqbal tells us to put aside personal interests and to move into a direction leading to social interests. Put aside your personal interests. Let's talk about our religion, our unity. We will end in success. Just because of his thoughts, Iqbal is living on today. I think so.
Just have a look at the tragic events caused by a group of people who are Muslims in name only, as if there has never been a person like Iqbal. His philosophy has sunk into oblivion, as if Iqbal never lived among us. This is a great sorrow, casting a shadow over all Iqbal's philosophy and thoughts. There is no memory of him anymore. The life of all his great books has gone out. The Everlasting Letter, The Familiar Secrets, The Secrets of Rapture, The Persian Psalms, What Can Be Done, O People of the East, The Route of Philosophy in Iran, The Eastern Message, and Reconstructing Islamic Religious Thoughts. During his last days, Allama says, as Iran, full of unknown meaning, I am unable to endure censurers' sayings. Neither have I any option, nor am I coerced. I am but a living soil, always in revolution.
इसी तरह जब आखिरी रात थी अलामा साहब की तो वो दोनों बच्चे इसी दरवाजे पे आए.
Then came the last night of Allama's life. His two children came to have their last look at him.
मिलने के लिए आया हुआ था.
Allama was still conscious. Someone from Germany had come to see him, a friend of his or his teacher. The German called the two children and hugged them. My father was leaving the room, but my aunt wasn't. She wanted to stay with him for a while.
At the time, I felt I had to stay with Allama and to sit there motionlessly. Our tutor, Aunt Doris, came there to take me with her. I told her, I will stay here at least for a while.
Allama told the tutor,
she knows that this is the last meeting between the father and the daughter. That is why she doesn't want to leave. Let her stay.
She knows this is the last time she sees her father. And finally, I felt something was going to happen. For that very reason, I didn't want to leave the place.
Early in the morning, Allama passed away. The muezzin was calling out the morning adhan. Here, beside this bed, was standing his close friend, Ali Bakhsh. There were some other friends too, although most of them were saying their morning prayers at the mosque at that time. Back then, the mosque was more like a house than anything else. Friends were there to say their prayers in congregation. After their prayers, Allama passed away. His last words were the two testimonies. Then his soul flew to the sky. I personally suppose people like Allama will come to this world several centuries later.
Allama Iqbal Lahori died at the age of 61 on April 21, 1938, after a life of diligence and hard work. In the last moments of his life, he put his hand on his chest, telling Ali Bakhsh, his man, "I have a pain here." And upon uttering this ambiguous, meaningful remark, he bade farewell to the world. Many attended his funeral and accompanied him to his final resting place next to Masjid-e-Shah in Lahore. On his deathbed, Allama composed this song. Does a song gone come back again? No, no, no. Does a breeze come from Hijaz? No, no, no. There finally came to an end all those days of poverty. Does a Gnostic come back a second time? No, 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 no. Allama's thoughts and philosophy will remain with us forever, only if we follow him.
Iqbal was a significant voice in the traumatic history of colonized India. His sensitivity to the plight of his people was sharpened both by his understanding of his roots and his adaptability to the demands of the new colonized world. Politics and philosophy were combined in Iqbal's poetry. Perhaps today, Iqbal's anti-colonial stance can be referred to as neo-colonialism is still plaguing the world. And that's it for this week's program. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim. all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The West is obliged to lift the sanctions against Iran immediately. Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, delivered a televised speech on the anniversary of the people of Qom's uprising against the oppressive Pahlavi regime. Imam Khamenei used to address the whole nation on the anniversary of the January 8, 1978, which is 19th of Day uprising, in the presence of thousands of people from Qom in the Husseiniya of Imam Khomeini. However, due to COVID-19 restrictions, His Eminence addressed the nation via a televised speech this year. It is a correct decision. It is a completely reasonable, logical, acceptable decision. When almost all of the other side's commitments in the JCPOA are not honored, it does not make sense for the Islamic Republic to honor all its commitments. This is why, since a while ago, they are gradually withdrawing from some of our commitments. And recently, too, they have withdrawn from some others. Of course, if they return to their commitments, we will return to ours as well. It is a source of dignity and pride for the country. Of course, they are working on the corona vaccine in different ways, but in one case, they are testing a vaccine on human beings and it has proven to be successful.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Importing American or English vaccines to country is prohibited. I have said this to the officials, and I am now announcing this publicly. If the Americans had been able to produce vaccine, the corona disaster would not have occurred in their own country. A few days ago, there were 4,000 deaths in their country in one day. If they know how to make a vaccine, and if their Pfizer factory knows how to produce one, they can use it for themselves so that there won't be so many deaths there. The same is true for England. They are not trustworthy or reliable. I don't know. Perhaps they wish to test a vaccine on other nations to see if it works or not. And of course, I do not trust French either. The reason is their history in giving us contaminated blood, France's HIV-tainted blood supplies.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah.
the debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Massive military drills of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps have come to an end. This after the IRGC has put on quite a show from central Iran to the Indian Ocean. Mock enemy vessels were targeted with long-range ballistic missiles with precision accuracy, hitting targets up to 1,800 kilometers away. Tehran says the maneuvers sent a message to adversaries to avoid attacking Iran, and military officers reiterate that Iran's might is for defensive means only. Stay with us as we take a look at these maneuvers on this debate.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day massive military exercise in central Iran. During the drills, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, IRGC destroyed Mach enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the maneuvers kicked off on Friday by firing surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and operating bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. The operations were launched in the presence of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said Iranian armed forces will respond with might and promptly in case of any hostile move against the Islamic Republic. The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The maneuvers are aimed at boosting combat readiness of the Iranian armed forces. The military drills come amid America's stepped-up military threats against Iran in the final days of U.S. President Donald Trump in office. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and imposed heavy sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Trump cited Iran's ballistic missile program, among other issues, as the reason. Tehran has time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. Like any other country, the Islamic Republic is entitled to boost its defense capabilities.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Helsinki, and author and journalist Eric Wahlberg out of Toronto. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with Brett. Tell us the significance of these latest drills and the timing of them in your perspective.
Well, I think the timing, of course, is of supreme importance here. We're talking about a very dangerous, very volatile time, being the last week now even, of the Donald Trump presidency. We know that Donald Trump is not exactly the most, let's say, held back person, not necessarily the most rational person as well when it comes to international policy in particular. We have seen what he is capable of. We have seen both domestically and in foreign affairs what he can do when he sets his mind to something, and it's not pretty. You know, it's nothing to be proud of. So, of course, for the Islamic Republic of Iran in particular, this is a very dangerous and threatening time. So I think that this is the perfect timing indeed to show such an impressive military advancement. We're talking about, according to sources within the Iranian military, that these long-distance ballistic missiles, these missiles that were fired at naval targets, this is a reach that has now been expanded from 300 kilometers in the past to 1,800 kilometers now, which means the Islamic Republic of Iran could fend off a naval aggression over 1,800 kilometers away before they would ever come anywhere near actually reaching the Iranian coast. So this is a very important symbol and a very important signal to make right now, to show that not just the people of the armed forces of Iran are ready to defend their country, but we're also talking about a very modern, high-tech military that has a drone and missile program at the ready in order to defend itself in case of any aggression.
Well, Eric, with what was displayed during the maneuvers and what you've seen, I want to ask you your perspective about the message that it could send and also about the preparedness of Iranian forces.
Well, I agree with Brett. This is a very important step that Iran takes at a very serious, crucial moment when Trump is still threatening and where when Biden is coming to power with promises to de-escalate the tensions with Iran and to return to the JCOAP, so the nuclear agreement. So I think that it's not an aggressive move. It's quite clearly it's a defensive move, and it's important for this point to be made before Biden is pushed by his Zionist backers to try and tell Iran to stop supporting Syria, to stop supporting the Houthis, to stop trying to stop the Israeli-U.S. aggression in the Middle East. That Iran's military might is dedicated to self-defense and to defending its allies in the region, and there's nothing subversive about this. It's all above board. It's all according to international law. And so I'm very comfortable to see these demonstrations, and it is encouraging to know that whereas Israel and U.S. are at the forefront of military production of offensive weapons, that Iran is not going to be held hostage to these clear enemies of peace in the Middle East.
Well, actually, Eric, I want to pick up on what you just said. You said you're very comfortable seeing this. Brecht, I want to look at that because, of course, we know how Iran is portrayed by many countries, especially Western countries, trying to show that it's basically a very aggressive country. What Eric just said, that he was comfortable because of showing it's the domestic and also defensive capability as opposed to offensive. I want to look at that aspect of it. Why is it that though Iran has not engaged in an offensive war in 200 years in modern history, it is continually labeled and condemned for being an aggressive nation?
Well, this is all, of course, part of the propaganda mill. Indeed, as Eric pointed out, the Zionist backers behind much of the Western governments, of the so-called leaders of the Western world, the Zionists and the imperialist war hawks in general, they have an extensive influence in trying to basically beef up these war drums and beef up this war propaganda. And one of their most commonly used phrases, of course, is projection. Is basically one of the most common tactics of projection, that with which I mean everything that the West does wrong is being projected on another country as if it comes from them. The Western powers will say that these other nations are the ones that are potentially imperialist, expansionist, aggressive, colonialist, or neocolonialist, and are a threat to the nations surrounding them. We have seen similar, clear examples of this in 2018, when Donald Trump made his demands to Iran. These demands include that Iran has to pull back from Iraq, even though they are there with the permission of the Iraqi government. They have to withdraw from Yemen, even though Iran is not involved in Yemen at all. They have to disengage from Syria, even though the Syrian Arab Republic has specifically asked, of course, for Iranian support in their defense against these terrorist movements that are incidentally backed by the West. So they project these sins and these crimes of the West and try to portray it as if it's Iran that does it, as if it's, for example, also the same thing happens with China, the same thing happens with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Every time when a nation that is not marching to the beat of the Zionists, to the beat of the imperialists in the West, they are portrayed as these madmen that are running around trying to destroy the world. And indeed, when you look at the situation on the ground, you see that Iran is surrounded on all sides by American bases, American forces, American soldiers, vessels, ships, planes, and the entire cabal of the military industrial complex of the United States, and in many ways also the United Kingdom, France, and much of the European Union, and of course the regional allies and puppet states such as Saudi Arabia. And so these, in order to masquerade what is going on here, the democratic West, as they call themselves, are trying to portray this orientalist image of the basically a return to the old you know, medieval and later Nazi propaganda of the hordes from the East, let's say, that are threatening the democratic West, the civilized West, so to say. This is a tale that has been going on for centuries. And in a modern capacity, we have seen this return time and again. We have seen this happen during the Korean War. We have seen this happen during the Vietnam War. We have seen this during the war against Iraq, the war against Syria, the war against Libya. And this is something that returns over and over again. So this is a psychological warfare. And unfortunately, it has been very, very successful up until recently. Now, fortunately, nowadays we have, of course, the internet and alternative independent media to combat this monopolization of press and monopolization of the written word that has been dominating the West for so long. But it still remains very, very difficult. And this is, of course, why the Iranian authorities called this the soft war. This is a war of its own, the war of words, the war of truth versus lies, that in many ways is equally important to the actual war of bombs and guns. And this is what is going on here right now, and the war that is being fought in the minds of people every single day.
Okay. Well, Eric, I mean, if we look at, Brecht just talked about the war of words. I want to go back to the actual physical war. 40 years ago, of course, when Iran was basically attacked by Saddam Hussein's led Iraq. And of course, Iran tried to get equipment and weapons from everywhere, but basically to no avail with the help of the U.S. and its allies. We fast forward now, 40 years later, more than 40 years later, and we see the type of technology being used, and a lot of this missile technology, homegrown. I want to look at that aspect and the significance of Iran being able to do this under such severe sanctions.
It's, to me, it's a miracle. I every day I think, wow, Iran is fighting the monster, and it's got enough intellectual capability to do that. And that it really is very impressive. I think that if we can get that message out to people will, it's not to make people afraid of Iran, it's to make people respect Iran and its attempt to forge an independent and socially just orientation in the international sphere. And I wanted to commend Brett on his psychoanalysis of the situation, that you looked at someone like Trump, he is really psychologically He's a very seriously tormented individual, and this projection that you see this every day, that people, they're full of hate and they project that hate onto someone else and say you are the problem. So I think this is on a world scale, we're having a lesson in the human tragedy and human comedy.
Well, Eric, let me just jump in here, because you talked about as far as Trump and projection. But is this a Trump problem? I mean, if we look at the history of the Islamic Republic of Iran, almost 42 years old now since the revolution, we've seen from the beginning this type of animosity that Washington has had against Tehran. And whether we're talking about Democrat like Carter or Republican with Reagan, or we fast forward all the way to Trump, it really hasn't seemed to have changed between the Democrats and Republicans as far as that animosity towards Iran and actually basically changing the narrative, as Brett has said, what they have done and their aggression, actually trying to show that it has been Iran. Let me throw this to Brett. Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, this is definitely a key point to make in terms of, you know, American politics. Yes, Donald Trump might be the mad dog of U.S. imperialism in a way, although I highly doubt that Donald Trump is the person who actually came up with things like, you know, assassinating Shahid Qasem Soleimani or the nuclear scientists in Iran who were murdered under his rule. He is more of a person who is... He is the dog let loose, let's say, of U.S. imperialism, whereas a person like Obama was a person who could show more restraint and could pretend to be more diplomatic. But in the end, their goals are the same. You know, we should not kid ourselves and believe that the the United States under Obama was using the JCPOA for a lasting peace. No, for them, they were hoping that through the JCPOA, they could somehow tame Iran into having, you know, like a velvet counter-revolution, you know, like one of those color revolutions that they've been doing in Eastern Europe ever since the late 1980s. You know, they were probably hoping for something like that. Whereas the war hawks of people like, you know, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and what have you, they are more of the, you know, the blood and fire kind of types who want to destroy the nation completely, everyone who is standing in their way, and basically see the destruction all over the place until the United States reigns supreme. But in the end, of course, their goals are similar. Indeed, we have seen aggressive behavior from Democrats like Carter and Bill Clinton and Obama, just as we have seen it from Reagan, Bush, and Trump. This is a cabal, again, to say that word, of a two-headed snake, let's say. These are two sides of the same coin in the United States. Both Democrats and Republicans eventually serve the same interests and have been serving the same interests ever since the country of the United States was founded. This is an issue that has been going on for decades and even centuries. So when you see, you know, Joe Biden take the lead and say, I want to return back to the JCPOA, I want to return back to the negotiation table, we have to be very, very suspicious of their intention, because Joe Biden has said, and that's very important, I believe, he said, we want to negotiate back with Iran, but only, and there it comes, of course, if Iran, quote-unquote, keeps strictly to the rules and regulations and the stipulations of the JCPOA. And the problem is that the Americans have shown time and again that their interpretation of what is written in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not necessarily what a normal person, you know, a neutral observer, mm-hmm. would believe that it says. They might use this document in order to pressure and push Iran even further.
And what we've seen, Brad, you were talking about using the JCPOA, and we've seen actually Trump talk about this, and others have hinted at it. Again, looking now at the missile technology. And Eric, I want to talk about that, because in these maneuvers that we just saw, one of it was actually Iran flexing its muscles with that missile technology. And there are those who say that even under a Biden administration, that perhaps they're going to try to go after that. Overall, I just want to look at the situation, and where do you think this is all going at this point in time between the United States and Iran?
Well, I don't really agree exactly with Brett, or perhaps with you, on the fact that there is a cabal and they're all the same in Washington. I think that was a brave move that Obama made. I don't know why he made it. I think he was trying to get to put Israel in its place, because the Stutz worm that was destroying the Iranian nuclear facilities for a while, that was a U.S.-sponsored secret program that was supposed to be under U.S. control, and Israel took it and ran and did what it wanted. So I think that there is a difference, and I think that Biden is a continuation of Obama. He must be aware of all of that background. He's no fool. And I think that I look at this, it's the same way as when there was detente with the Soviet Union in the 70s, when the U.S. was weak, and it made an agreement with the Soviet Union, and it was very positive. It was very positive for the world. It relaxed the tension. And I really hope, and perhaps I'm being too optimistic, but I hope that Biden will fulfill his pledge to return to the program, allow Iran to get its economy back in shape, and to live peacefully in the region with the other people. Iran is not an enemy of Israel. If Israel would just stop being such an aggressive and horrible nation, everyone could make peace with it. So I think that Iran plays a vital role here to stand up to the power and speak the truth. And I really hope that will happen. I'm trying to be optimistic. We've got a few days before Biden comes to power. Let's hope that he does what he should.
Well, Brett, your take. Eric said basically obviously you heard him, that he's very optimistic. But what it seems, that if we look again at the more than four decades of the existence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is that Washington has a problem with Iran being independent and even morally supporting other independent movements. Your take on the future between these two countries now?
Of course, it's very hard to predict, let's say, or to think about what will happen. But I always try, of course, to be, you know, somewhat optimistic myself in regards of what the future might bring. You don't want to look at it too negatively, of course. But I believe that there is a chance that the United States will eventually learn to, you know, leave Iran alone and let Iran, you know, develop its country the way they want to, and develop ties with whatever country they want to, and within the axis of resistance, for example, and beyond, and that America will eventually learn how to cope with it, to deal with it. But I believe the only way in which this is possible is by Iran basically building up its capacities for self-defense and its say, its weight in world politics to such an extent that the United States will be forced to recognize the situation as it is. I believe one of the examples I could use for a nation that has in the past faced incredible hostility from the United States and is now considered by the United States as a normal, respectable partner in everyday politics is Vietnam. Of course, I sincerely hope that Iran does not have to go through the terrible tragedy that Iran had to go through for decades in order to get to that position. But it is a fact that the United States was eventually forced, starting in the, you know, mid and late 1970s, to declare that they were basically, that they had been defeated, that their goals, their plans had been foiled, had failed completely due to the resistance and resilience of the Vietnamese. And ever since then, give or take certain disagreements, the United States and Iran, and Vietnam are treating each other more or less as equal partners, as just normal nations that conduct diplomacy and trade with one another.
Okay.
So eventually, if Iran really shows itself to be the strong regional power that they are and that they have every right to be, I believe only that will eventually force the United States to come to the conclusion that they cannot win this.